You know, our speaker this morning is a member of the Episcopalian Church. I have had, as most of you know, some experience with the Methodist Church. I hadn't thought of this for quite some time, but up at Charlotte, a few years back, I met Dr. Sam Shoemaker for the first time, a wonderful man now that has gone on. We had an open meeting in Charlotte, and it was held at the Methodist Church. Dr. Shoemaker got up, and his opening remarks were that he was very happy to be back in the pulpit of this Methodist Church. He said that he was very sorry that the Methodists and the Episcopalians saw fit to split up. He said that the Episcopalian Church very much needed the Methodist Church to build the fire so that the Episcopalians could fan it. I am quite sure this morning that this is what John is going to do for you and for us. I don't know him. I've never heard him talk before. I'm looking forward to it, to my friend and yours, Reverend John Van Dee from Oklahoma.
Morning. My name is John Van Dyke, and I'm an alcoholic. September the 3rd was 20 years ago that I came in AA. That not only makes you an old timer, but also a very dangerous person. For as you well know, old-timers fall by the wayside many more times than young-timers. You can get, in this program, you can get in a rut. And a lot of old-timers are getting in a rut. This morning, a young fellow came to me, and he was sitting down and had a cup of coffee, and he said, I would like to hear someone say I'm in AA 20 years. He doesn't know it, but damn it, he heard it. That's the first remark I'm going to make. The second one is this. I was not always this way. There is a hymn. I think the Methodists sing it. I was not always Dutch, you know, T-H-U-S. I'm a Dutchman, I have a hell of a time with T-H. I think one of the reasons that I like to go out to AA meetings is I like to preach, but I like to speak to alcoholics much more. They are in a different kind of fellowship. These rich old ladies, they don't need God and God doesn't need them. But we are a little different. You know, John was talking last night about Tom was talking last night about fellowship. We are basically the fellowship of the redeemed. You see? And by being redeemed from alcohol, we are become or have become the company, the fellowship of the faithful. The people full of faith and hope. And yes, as he said, full of love. And so this is the church. The other one, as far as I'm concerned, so many times has become the country club. and they just as well can make a swimming pool right out of the parking lot. And start taking in admission. I was talking in a very large church of another denomination. You know, the Episcopalians don't give me all the chances to speak.
No wonder.
They first tried to hold me back to go in the ministry. But when God wants you to do something, he brings it to pass. Forget it. You know, in spite of. And now I speak many more times in churches of other denominations. And they asked me to come to the opening of a $2.5 million church of another denomination. And I was a little dumbfounded. And I said, I'm going to prophesy something. Isaiah didn't have anything on me, you know. Huh. Well, no, I can tell you who's going to be drunk in half a year from now. I said, this church will be a bowling alley in 25 years. And the whole congregation. There will be a lot of bowling alleys. Well, now, so far, no more. You know, most people, when they see a fellow with a white collar and a black shirt on and a silver string around his neck, this is not to tie you up, you know. Get it straight. And they hear that he is dean of a cathedral, which is the second highest job in the United States in the Episcopal Church. They say, well, this fellow never could have been a drunk.
Here is one, brother.
Let me tell you a few things about my story, then you start to realize why I'm here and that I'm one of you. I was born not in this country. I was born in a small country in Holland. You can still hear that, especially in the south. And I believe that every man or woman, when he is young, wants to become a happy person. We set out to do this. I was born in a very small village. My father didn't have any money at all. He was an educated man. He came from an extremely old family. But you know, old families lose their money. And therefore, the task before me was to make money back. For we find generally that our happiness lays in things. You ask a young man out of high school what he thinks would make him happy, then he would say a Thunderbird, wouldn't he? Huh? That's a thing. See? And when you get a little older, then you want to have a beautiful girl, you know, stacked like a cathedral. And you think when you have that, then you become a happy man. And when you still get older, then you want to have a beautiful home. And you think if you have that beautiful home, it's going to be just make you happy. And then after you have all these things, car and you know, this, and a home, then you want to have money. I say, if I only would have money now, then I'm going to be a happy man. Isn't it wonderful? And you try to do those things, and then you get them all, and you ain't happy. My job was to get money, as far as I was concerned. That would make me happy. I was sick and tired of second-hand clothes. I was sick and tired of second-hand books. God gave me a good brain and a good mind, and I started to study. I was pretty early. I got a bachelor's degree when I was 16. And then I wanted to make money. I went to an office, and I went to one of those European offices. Take care, I'm old. I'm an old man. I'm 56, 57. And I became an office boy. I didn't want to go further. And I started to work for 25 guilders a month, which is about $8. When, after 1 year, I found out that if I only was a technical man, a scientific man, and I was a businessman, then I could make five times as much. And so I started to study again. I became a doctor of chemistry. I have 2 doctorate degrees. I have a doctor of chemistry and a doctor of engineering. And now I was ready
And at 23, I became president of a company, of an oil company in Holland. And when I was 24, I had reached the top of salary in that small country. I made now just as much as the prime minister, and the country became too small. What are you going to do? In the meantime, I had indulged in a number of things that a lot of people don't indulge in, but I had studied very hard, and you know when you study very hard and many things are forgiven, I believe if you have loved very much, much will be forgiven. So what I had to do is to come to this country, to America, for I was taught that in America the dollar bills were hanging on the trees, and if you worked hard, you could get plenty of them. And my idea was to come here, work hard, collect all the dollar bills, and then finally, after about 10 or 15 years, go back to my country and buy a rocking chair and rock. And of course, this has to be said of this country, that if you want to do something, you can do it. I don't think there is any limit to it. The only thing what I cannot become is president of the United States, for I'm not born here. But the rest I can. And I worked very hard, and now comes the trouble. Now comes the great trouble. I came here, was sent out from Europe by a small distilling company. And he knows that company. For I was a chemist, I was an engineer, I was a businessman, and I had good taste. This is bad. I was sent over here, this is many years ago, 32 years ago. I came to this country, and I became manager of, this was just after the peel, of a small distilling company from Holland. And my salary was high in those days. I had a very good salary in Holland, but I came here higher, and I was really on my way. And then, you know, when you work hard, then luck is always with you. Luck is never with people who don't work hard. You know that? Remarkable. I worked very hard. I always had a capacity for this. I had to take two jobs instead of one. I can't sit still. I still can't sit still. And one day, one of the big companies in Puerto Rico had troubles in their manufacturing business, and they were asking who would volunteer to go over there and straighten this thing out. In Puerto Rico, the company made, the big parent company made both antifreeze and rum, that comes out of the same spigot, by the way. They had trouble with the rum, and they asked for a volunteer who would do this, and of course, you know me, and I was not an alcoholic. Now, get that straight. And I said, I'll go. And I was back in 5 days, and the thing was done. And then my salary was made four times as large, and I was put in charge of all foreign production and all foreign research, for I spoke 6 or 7 or 8 languages. And now began the trouble. For here was this young fellow who came from a small country, like Moses, a stranger in a strange land. And he had gotten it too good. He made too much money. And he traveled in circles where he never traveled in. And he was traveling all over the world with an expense account unlimited. I came here and lived in a small apartment in New York. And I bought a big place first in Montclair, New Jersey. And then I bought myself an estate. I had my own plane. I had my own chauffeur, my own butler, my own farmer. I was young. I was home half a year out of the year. And I traveled with people who made the headlines in the newspaper here and abroad. But you see, I came from a small village in Holland. My life had been spent in studying. I knew probably chemistry better than anybody else who I met. But there were a lot of things I did not. And if I went for a few days skiing in Switzerland, then I didn't know how to ski. But if I took a bottle of scotch and did drink it, brother, I could ski. And I went to Scotland, and I lived there for a while, and they went grouse hunting. Hell, I didn't know what a grouse was. But boy, after a bottle, I could grouse hunt. And they went fox hunting, and I could do all these things. They talked about horses, and I didn't know how many hands a horse was. But, oh, God, when I had half or two bottles, you know, then I could talk horses like anybody else. And so I started to drink for reasons of, inferiority complex. Let's call it that way. I think all of us do this. Dutch courage. I'm a Hollander, a Dutchman. And here is where I started to drink about. And then I met these people who knew so much more than I did. And they had an education which was completely different than mine. I cannot give you names. I would be very glad to do this, but it would break great confidences. These people had traveled all over the world. They were very well known. They could talk on subjects I never could talk about. They talked about philosophy, and they talked about ethics, and they talked about all these things, and I had to keep my mouth shut. But when I had a few bottles, oh boy. I spoke 7 or 8 languages, and I was always addressing big groups on some technical problems all over the world. And when I had a bottle or two, then I could speak 16 languages. I remember I was in his country, we had a plant there, and I met the prime minister, and of course you got drunk. What are you going to say to the prime minister? You see, and this is how my story begins. The little boy out of the little country, of the little village, was sitting on the top now, and he couldn't handle it. You know, a lot of people probably were very jealous when they saw me drive by and see me go to the train. We had our own car, we had our own club car, and they saw a chauffeur come and pick me up, and they probably said, boy, oh boy, look at that. He came here, this greenhorn, about 10 years ago, and now look. And they didn't know, however, what was happening inside here. You know, we don't have any radar. We can look into people. Someday, it may be we have that. And then comes the tragedy. For you see, you know, I think so halfway, that there is something wrong with you, and you want to know how to drink right instead of drinking wrong. But you don't know how to do it. You can't. And I remember that approximately 30 years ago, 28 years ago, I went to a bookstore and I bought the book, the green cover book, or the yellow cover book. That was the very first edition. You remember that. And I had it under my arm, and of course you didn't show it, you know, you packed it. And I had lunch with a fellow of mine, and I said, a friend of mine, and I said, you know, I can't keep this up. I start to drink in the morning. This was my job. I did drink for lunch. That was my pleasure. I did drink for in the afternoon. That was my job. I did drink for dinner. That was my pleasure. And at night, I didn't know. And in the middle of the night, you got up and you still were drunk. And I was drunk 3 times a day and 3 times sober. And it didn't cost me anything, for I made this stuff. That makes a difference too, you know. I never did drink any rotten stuff. I always did drink the very best. The very best there is. And we had lunch, and I said, well, I'm going to do something about it. He said, you know, I have a wife and children, and you are a bachelor. Why don't you give it to me? And I sold the book for 2 double martinis with 1 onion in it. Then comes the suffering. Now, take care of what I'm saying here is my own opinion. I believe there's no one going to grow up without suffering. No one. There is no one going to really get a sobriety without having suffered. Suffered is part of our basic humanity. Makes us grow up. And comes a time, as you well know, and some of you may well know, that you start to shake. And you start to shake in the morning. And you start to shake in the afternoon. And you start to shake at night. And then comes a time that you start to shake and to start to pray. And God is very wise. He doesn't listen. Shaking and praying at the same time. That's pretty good. You become the loneliest man in the world. The remarkable fact is that you think you're the only one in the whole world, too. No one else. Say, poor little you. Poor little me. Now, I have all these things. I live in this big estate, and I have all these people under my command, and they don't know, and you start to even sneak your own drinks. I mean, this is worse. Then some of us are very fortunate. I was. For you see, nature has cause and effect. And if you drink to that extent, then something happens to your brain. And you can't think right. And if you don't think right, something happens to the things you have. And so, my boss and myself and a friend of mine were called in one day to the big company. We were all, I think, vice presidents of 9 or 10 corporations. And they had tried to get insurance on us, but they couldn't get it. You know, alcoholism, without going into detail, brings with it some physical deterioration. I mean, let's be honest on that. And I had some cardiac difficulty, and I couldn't see very well, you know. And from time to time, your pupils get a little yellow, and that means your liver has a touch of something. And you can't get any insurance. See, and these fellows couldn't get any insurance, so they said to us that in view of that fact that we would jeopardize the whole program of the whole company, which, by the way, had something like 80,000 employees, well, what we should do is take a year leave of absence. Now, you know what that is, a year leave of absence. That means, boy, you have done a good job, but now get the hell out. We took a leave of absence for 1 year, and the three of us had been given half a year to live if we kept on doing what we were doing. And in 3 months' time, my boss, one of the greatest men I've ever met, and I've met a number of great men, he called me up one evening and said, "Johnny, how are you doing with your drinking?" And I said, "I don't do a bit of good." He said, "I don't either." The next day, I got a telephone call that he was dead. He had bled to death. And a month later, my other friend also died in an alcoholic stupor. And now I was alone. 3 musketeers and 1 was left. Not much chance. 2 months to go. And then, of course, I lost everything I had. When I was 35, I could have retired. I had enough money to live for good. And when your thinking is wrong, your investing is wrong, and I lost, I think, something like $350,000, $400,000 in 1 year. And I had to sell my house. I had to sell my estate. I had to sell my plane. The last thing, what I held on to at all costs, was my Cadillac. Still an alcoholic. Status symbol. I didn't have any more money, and I had to move into an $8 a week room. I had come to this country with nothing. In 11 years, I had gone to the very top, but also to the very bottom again. And now I had less as when I came in. You know, remarkable, I had lost all my friends also. When I was in big business, I had so many friends. Oh, they loved to come to my home. I had the finest wine cellar in New Jersey. I got all my liquor for nothing, and they all got drunk. Wonderful. I was a great guy. And then I didn't have anything anymore. And no liquor. And no home. And no friends. And there came a time when I would have loved that someone came to me and said, John, do you need $10? And I would have accepted it, for I didn't have any. But no one came. I've often told this story. The year before this, I got something like 400 Christmas cards and some 20, 30 Christmas presents. And then I lost everything I had, and my job. And that year, when I moved to this $8 a week room, I got 4 Christmas cards, and they came from California. They didn't know it yet. Now, I don't think you can get lower than that, can you? No job, nothing, no money. Back. My own brother told me he never would talk to me anymore. I was a disgrace for the family. Now, I'm going to say a few things here, but a lot of people may not agree on. There are 3 things going together all the time. An alcoholic is not just an alcoholic. Sex, alcohol, and pills always go together. You know, we don't talk about this in AA meetings. We say, oh, poor little alcoholic. Hell is it? Sex, alcohol, and tranquilizers or pills or whatever they are always go together without an exception. The reason that we are drinking is we want to be a man. And we ain't. And the reason that we are sober and we drink again, we want to be a man, and we get older, and hell, we are going to tackle down. That's all. I know by experience. And so I had quite a past. You understand now what I'm trying to say. And not only do they go together, but they are a result of one another. This is Sunday morning, and we better be truthful. I always had loved beautiful looking women, and I still do. And I thank my God for it. For there is nothing better. Well, anyway. And here I was sitting in this $8 a week room and still drinking. You know, one day I came home at night and, of course, drunk. And someone had been in my one room. The next morning, when I could open my eyes, there was a book there. I remember that book. That was a yellow-covered book. And the landlady told me that an old lady of about 67, 68, that's old. I was that time a young man. Had brought it. And she wouldn't tell who she was. And the only thing what she said was that she knew that this young fellow had so much trouble with drinking and this might help him. And if she could put that book next to my bed. And she did. And of course, I'm nosy and you are nosy. And we start to read and we want to find out something about what. And I start to read the book and I read something about alcoholics. And she had left a note in that book that there would be a meeting of these people in a church. And if I wanted to have more information, to call that church. And I called that church and the rector answered, and he said, are you in trouble? And I said, no. I said, well, now, it may be that you're not in trouble right now, but how about tonight? And he said, well, no, I don't think so. I said, well, why don't you come over anyway? Come over at 5 o'clock. Now, there's a long stretch, you know, from 10 o'clock in the morning till 5 o'clock at night. And I promised this holy man that I would come and see him. Now, you must realize that I'm a scientist. I had become an agnostic. I hadn't been in church for, I think, 18 years. When I was a young man, I went to my father, who was religious, and my mother, and I said, I will never go to the church anymore. I can't believe in all that nonsense. I listen during the day in university or college to what my professors have to say, and then Sunday morning I go and have to listen to a sermon, what a dope says, and one of the two is wrong. And I can't believe, well, that is that crap I don't believe in anymore. I never will go to church anymore. Now, my father was a wise man. And for you fathers and mothers, I tell you something. You know what my father said? Bless his soul, he's dead. He said, son, he said, you are not 40 years old yet. That's all he said. He didn't say you must go, you have to go, what more? The only thing he said is, son, you are not 40 years old yet. And that was very wise. When he would have said to me, you have to do this and you have to do that, I wouldn't be standing in front of you here today. And so I hadn't been in church. I didn't know what the church was. I'm not an Episcopalian either. Born, heck no. But I promised this man of God that I was going to see him when I was in trouble that same day about 5 o'clock. And of course, I was drunk as a pie. And then I experienced something what very few people experience, but I know that Tom has, for I heard him say that. And he was a man who loved me for what I was. And he started to talk, and not too much. And he put his arms around me, and in an hour time, I was just as sober as a judge. And I made him a promise. That was, and I still remember this, it was on a Thursday night. I promised that I would be at an AA meeting on Sunday night. And here was a holy man who loved people. And he was not an alcoholic. You know, we think we have the monopoly. There are some other people who do too. And what happened between Thursday and Sunday, I better don't tell you. I may shock you. Only I know that I woke up on Sunday morning in a hotel in New York. On one side, at least, was a bottle. I didn't know what had happened in those past days, but later I found out I had bought two new Cadillacs on credit. And I promised this man that I would be at the meeting in New Jersey, and I drove to New Jersey, and I was not feeling so good. But he was waiting for me. When I came to that meeting, it was September the 3rd. 20 years ago. And there were a group of people who didn't have any bachelor's degree, nor master's degrees, nor doctor's degrees, and they never had achieved very much in life. That was in the very beginning of AA, you must remember. There was one fellow with one eye. He had drunk too much wood alcohol, and now he was making baskets. But he was sober. And one thing what stood out, they dared to look one another in the eye. And they were happy people. I don't know what anyone said at that meeting. I'm not interested either. But at the end of the meeting, that darn coffee came. And you know that just as well as I do that you can't hold a cup of coffee. I mean, this is the way it goes. And then one fellow came to me who had become a very good friend of mine. And he said, Johnny, he said, don't worry about that. I came here last week and I got in an alcoholic convulsion. I'd been to my first meeting. And after that meeting, I don't know what happened. I never took another drink anymore. But the next day, a man called, and he's dead now too. from 35 miles away. And he was a milkman. And he called on the phone long distance. It cost him something like 45 cents. And he called at night to find out how Johnny was. You know, people generally had called me and they wanted a favor. And this fellow only had met me once, and I was just a drunk like he was, but he wanted to find out how I was. And that kept me sober for 24 hours. And then that old lady, a day later, came to the house, and it's a good thing she didn't show her face, for she looked like a horse. But she only gave a package, and in that package were 6 or 7 pieces of candy and a little note on it. And on that note was, "Johnny, if you like to have a drink from time to time, a piece of candy will help you." And I had gotten many presents in my life, thousands and thousands of dollars, but never anything like that. And you know, she was very wise. She was a good sponsor, for she probably knew that if I would ever see her right when I started to become sober, I would get drunk again, for I hated horse-faced women. And 15 years ago, this woman died in my arms. And tomorrow is All Saints Day. And I don't give a hoop about saints of England and the saints of Rome and saints' word. But she is a saint. The only thing she ever did is help get Johnny Van Dyke sober. And she died in my arms, and she is there, all right. That's great. And so I was sober now for 2 days, and then the third day we went to a meeting. You know, I will tell you something to the young people, the newer people here. The first year I went to 168 meetings. There are people who think that they can go to one meeting a week and stay sober. Hell no. The only way that anyone can stay sober in a long time is, like Tom said, you have to keep on growing. The very moment you stop growing, you're licked. I went to all these meetings and I started to work with people. Don't be afraid to start working with people. What you have to give out. And you can't do any harm, really. And then don't start with the top flight people. Start with the people who don't have anyone to love. And I started to go to reformatories and to jails. And then finally, you know, in those days you had to meet all the old timers. And an old timer was someone who was sober for 2 years, and 3 years, and 4 years. You know that. And the last old timer I had to meet was a fellow by the name of Walter Benfield. Some of you know him. He is a good friend of Bill Wilson. And I had to go to Walter, and for, you know, they looked you over, and they figured out, is he a phony or ain't he? Well, he looked me over, but I looked him over too. And he had a beautiful daughter, which I didn't know. And when I came into his house, he was knitting Argyle socks. Now that was something new, for the girls I knew didn't knit Argyle socks at their age. And I think the old timers approved of me, and then we started to go together. And he is the fellow who started the groups in New Hampshire, in Maine, Vermont. He spoke all over the place, and it was then Walter Benfield and his son-in-law. And I resented the hell out of it, too. Finally, I married his daughter. We've been married now for... I was sober half a year when I married his daughter, and you can just figure out what happened. I mean, this was the closest he ever come by getting drunk. Figure out that you have one daughter. And you are sober for 4 years, and then a drunk comes in who is 15, 16 years older, with a hell of a reputation, and he's going to marry your daughter. Now you come pretty close to getting drunk. We started to go out together as a team. We went to meetings, we have been all over. Well, you see, when you get sober, you get, as it were, a credit in a bank, something like that. And you have to give it out. When you never have given out anything at all, your credit is no good. But the more you give, the more you get. Well, I was sober now. I started my business again. I was worked again very hard. I started my own business. Within four years, I had my own home. I had two children. But something else had happened. You know, all of you have these 12 steps. The early 12 steps were not the same as these are. Did you know that? There is a difference. We tame them down a little bit. In the book of 25 years ago, the last step is a little different. The last step is having had a spiritual experience instead of awakening. Well, I was an agnostic. That means I said, God may be and God may not be. I don't care. I can do it better. Until I came to the point 20 years ago that I needed the idea of God much more than God needed me. And out of nowhere came then the experience of what? For it is so easy to say that you believe in God. And it is so easy to stand up and read the creeds and to pray, and it becomes all a lot of nonsense. But we have to experience the power for good. When you know that there is, when you have experienced that there is no one who loves you, no one who gives a damn if you live or die. When you yourself think from time to time, and I have tried to commit suicide, when you think from time to time that it is easier to die than to live, and then all of a sudden out of nowhere comes this power which takes you and brings you. I was so glad that Tom said this yesterday. Not only this power knowing that it is good, but takes you and brings you. We call it coincidence. You know, I'm a scientist. I know more about mathematics than you do. There ain't no such thing as coincidence. That doesn't jive with the probability law at all. Well, I had an experience of this power for good. And I don't care what people call it. And I wanted to find out more about this power for good. And then to find out if this power for good works, the only thing to do is follow it. You know, when you want to believe in a leader, the only thing you can do is follow the leader. And if he brings you to victory, then it is the leader you thought he was. But you cannot sit on the sidelines and say, the hell was it, I'm going to look what he's doing. Then, and then after a few months, in AA, something else happened, and that is that, and you very seldom talk about this, but I think this is a good time to talk about it. You were sober now, and you still didn't know what your goal in life was. And then it may be during the day or during the night, and it may be both. Then all of a sudden, you know, you speak to a person. And a person speaks to you. And he tells you what to do. He tells you what to do. Don't believe in all that nonsense that God doesn't speak today. He is speaking today much more so than he ever did. And then you know what to do. And I remember that day and night when I could speak 16 languages or 20. They could have sent me to Arabia and I would have been able to speak Arabian. I knew that I had to go in the field of telling people that there is this power of love, which is God. But then you're up against the organization. For 4 years, I tried to get in the church. Now, take care, I'm not born an Episcopalian, so that is not, I'm not talking for the Episcopal Church only. I'm talking for all of them. You see, the church is a place for good people. For dodos. I'm a scientist. I'm not going to accept anything except by observation. And I couldn't take this. I was brought up in a church where God was a policeman who would hit me over the head if I did wrong. And if I did so many things wrong that I would go to hell. I had been there. No one had to tell me about that. But now I also knew another thing, that I make also my own heaven. But I was there now. Not all the time, but the mountaintops. And the mountaintops got greater and greater and greater. And then I wanted to go in the church. And the church said, you are a bad boy. I had been a playboy. Those of you from New York, there are a few here. Charlie Knickerbocker even wrote about poor little me. And they even didn't give me a broom to clean the church. My hands weren't clean enough yet. But you know, I said in the beginning, when God wants you to do something, then don't worry about it. Finally, I was confirmed in the church. The reason that I'm in the Episcopal Church is that it gives me the complete freedom to think. God gave me a brain. He doesn't want me to accept anything. He gave me a brain to think, and I may use that brain. That's godly. This is God's will. I was confirmed, and then I went to my rector, and I said I would like to go in the ministry. And he said, huh, you? Well, anyway, but a year or two later, we have in the Episcopal Church Lenten services, you know, Ash Wednesday. And I was making good in the world again. I had now a wife and 2 children, and a lot of people came over to me. We always had some stray cats on the, you know, on the couch someplace like that. And there was a rule in my home that in the first place, no one could, we didn't have any drinks in the house. They could bring their drinks and we would give them 7 up, but they'd take it out then again. And secondly, if you were in my home, then you did what the head of the household, that's me, not my wife, wants you to do. And so on Ash Wednesday evening, we went to church, and there were four other people with me and my wife. And we come to this church, and of course it is very bad weather in New Jersey, you know, this is the time of sleet and snow, and we went to this very large church, which was endowed of late with $2.5 million or something like that. And there were 13 people, and I had brought 6. Now, you know me well enough by now to know that I cannot let an opportunity like that pass to say a few chosen words. The minister didn't want even to preach. But I went across the street where a meeting was for alcoholics, and there were 150 people. It was the same weather. And so I went back to that man. I said, what you better do is start pouring cocktails from the altar. You get someplace. He never forgave me for that. But it got me into trouble for the next year. He said, well, when you think that you can do it better, then you are going to preach. I make you now a lay reader, and you are going to say a few chosen words yourself in this church. Well, it was a big church, and well, when people heard that Johnny Van Dyke was going to talk, of course, every drunk came. I still remember my first talk. You know, I sweated over that for 6 weeks. Believe me, I've never been as nervous. And it was about the pearl of great price. It took 7 minutes. I must have worked 700 hours on it. But all the drunks were there. And the church was packed. And then after that had happened, and I had done this for 6 weeks, then there was a meeting of the priests and the bishops of the state of New Jersey. And one of the great men of Virginia Theological Seminary was going to speak, by the name of Mulligan. And then Mulligan got sick. And at 9 o'clock in the morning, I got a telephone call from the chairman of the program, who asked me if I was daring to speak for all these, you know, theologians and bishops and bishops. And I said, sure, I don't have anything to hide. And he said, what are you going to talk about? And I said, I'm going to talk about God. I said, well, that is a subject they are familiar with, isn't it? Huh? And I talked about the God of experience instead of the God from the book. Hell was the book. And then after half an hour, I said, are there any questions? Huh. That was the stupidest thing I ever did. Well, there was an hour and a half questions. But after, in that same afternoon, I got a call from the bishop's office, and he said, John, I understand you want to go and become a priest. I said, yeah. He said, I want to see you tomorrow morning. So I come over to the office of the bishop, and he said, you're not afraid for me at all, are you? I say, no. Why should I be? Huh. He said, why do you want to become a priest? He said, well, now, Bishop Atheism. He said, I have done everything wrong in the book. And a lot of things which aren't even in the book. For I invented them. And I'm good at that. But I know one thing for sure, that black can become white. I know by experience that you can start all over again. And it is all behind you. He said, I'll pray about it. I said, you better don't do a lot of praying. You better take orders from your boss, too. I meant it. You know, most of us think that praying is asking. Huh? Praying is listening. Praying is listening what he has to say to you. And the bishop had to listen to him. But he listened good. For the next morning he called me and said, you're going to be in the seminary 3 days from today. Are you ready to go? I said, yep. And I gave up my business. And my wife had said, okay. And she lived with 2 children. And I went to the seminary and I lived like a monk. That ain't good for young people. And then a man of a mission, just very close to where I lived, got a heart attack, and they didn't know who to put in charge there. And they were going to close it anyway. So they said, well, you better be in charge there. And then the people left, for they said, how far down can you get when you only can get one of those crazy fellows to be the head of this church? I went to seminary and I got ordained as a deacon and then as a priest, and I stayed at that mission. And that mission was one of those places where you have to have a gold and great invitation to come to the women's meeting. You know how that is, huh? Well, they changed that in a hurry. There were 17 people there. And then all the drunks came. And all the people in trouble came. And we had a ball. I was lay reader and seminarian, and then was deacon, and then was priest, and then was a vicar, that is the head of a mission, and then the church grew and grew and grew till it came out of the seams. And when I left 5 years ago, we had 1,000 people. And they were all people in trouble. No good ones at all. And I didn't make any money in the ministry. I didn't want to. I got permission to run my own laboratories, and I had until 5 years ago. I made my own money in the ministry. I had two laboratories, chemical laboratories in New Jersey and two in Europe, and I flew up and down and I went all over the place and I had a ball. And I would go to chemical meetings this way and said, huh? Yeah, they can see who I am. Right? Set apart. You know, when you walk through the hospital this way, they know you ain't no plumber. And there's another thing, when I am dressed this way, I'm not going to sit at the bar either, you know. good protection. From time to time, I had to take this off, and you know, my children say that Daddy is going to be dressed with a regular shirt and a tie. I said, Daddy is going to make money. This way, Daddy doesn't make money at all. And then I left New Jersey. From time to time, it is a good thing to move. Don't stay at one place. When I was in this small community, which was next to the community I grew up, or where all my trouble was, only the sight of a white collar and a black shirt on Johnny Van Dyke was sermon enough. I never had to preach very much. You see? And now I had to go out further where there was more trouble. And I went to Oklahoma City. And there is plenty over there. Whew! You know how it is in our church, you get up. I have now one of the highest jobs in the church. There are 50 deans in all the United States, and I happen to be dean of a cathedral. That's pretty high up. But we have a hell of a lot of drunks again. And still, I'm talking to drunks and people in trouble. I think this is what God wants me to do. Some of us, including myself, have the experience of God. We know that He loves us in spite of us. We know that the past is behind us, and we don't have to forget. But like he said, we are forgiven. I was talking to Billy Graham, who happens to be a friend of mine, by the way. And you know, Billy said one thing to me once. When we talked about forgiveness, you know what it is? Our brains, we know now, are something like a recording instrument. And I hope you have seen a recorder, a good tape recorder. On a good tape recorder are a few knobs. And one of the knobs is record, and the other one is erase. See, and all the things we do are recorded in our brain. We know this. This is scientifically correct. And I want to find out what you thought, what you did 13, when you were 13. I can put a few probes in your brain and I can recall this. That can be brought electronically to you. Now, forgiveness is something like this. Instead of recording, God put the erasing knob down. It's great, isn't it? Even God Himself and doesn't remember anymore. And this erasing knob has to be down every day. Still, you see, this is forgiveness. And so you can start with a clean tape every day. And when we get sober, then we start with the whole collection of clean tapes. And the past is gone. And the only thing we have to worry about, or not to worry about, is the future. For we have had now the experience of that there is this power greater than we are. And let us not worry so much about doctrinal and forget about if we are Presbyterian or Episcopalian or that baloney. Doesn't make any sense. Let's only think about one thing. Do you know God by experience? Not from a book. I have never heard about anybody who did read themselves into God, into good theology. Never. But you know, when you start to read and study theology like I have to do, oh brother, you get all mixed up. But when you have an experience of what it can do, just the same as these lights, you see,
Never, no one has ever seen any electricity, have they? But I trust and I know that if I use that switch on the wall, electricity will go through the wires and I can see. God is like that. Simple. But we have to put the switch on most of the time. And be ready to put the switch on. Day after day. That's why we have to start our day and end our day with that. God is like that. God is love. Then 2 years ago, something else happened. You know, I want to warn you, those of you who are a little older, when you abuse your body, then you have to bear the consequence. Even God cannot take that away. Sorry. If I take a hammer and I start to knock with a big hammer at that pillar and the cement is coming off, then God is never going to put the cement back. You see, you have to do that. And I had abused my body and my mind and I got 2 heart attacks 2 years ago. And I'm not playing, sorry me. Good thing. Good thing. I can talk about heart attacks now. I have an experience, you see, about heart attacks. Yeah, this is the way I look at things. And you know, from time to time, experiences give great things. Great things. When I had my heart attack a day or two later, the head of one of the great medical schools in this country called me from Paris, France, and asked if I would keep track of exactly my emotions and record them. And one day a preacher came in with the big Bible under his arm and he had a long face. And darn it if I didn't have another heart attack. Now, you saw in Time magazine of about half a year ago, there's a whole new theory on what heart attacks are now like. And this came out of that kind of experiences all. You see, it is resentment and what more. Now, I have grown up. You know, 20 years ago, there was not anybody who liked me, and I didn't like anybody. Not one. When I got my heart attack, I was in the hospital for 2.5 months. In the first month, I got 1,400 letters from people. And half of them I even didn't know. I had just met at meetings like this. I had done something. The grace of God had gone through. I had become a little channel to the big reservoir, which is the reservoir of love and goodness, the power of God. And they responded. And then you felt yourself carried by those people. That's praying, you see. You don't have to be a dodo and pray this way. Think good. You feel yourself carried. And I got better. This is my first time out over the weekend. I wouldn't have missed those heart attacks for the money in the world. New experience. God is good. He can do anything. And so here we are in AA. You know what we have, what no one else has? We have an experience of the goodness of God. How good He is. And tomorrow on this All Saints Day, I remember quite a number of people. People I have known. But when you are 20 years sober and you have been speaking all over the place like I have, then you know that thousands of people have died who you saw once upon a time. They have done their part and they are saints. But you know what a saint is? A saint is someone through whom the light shows. You see? A saint is not someone who walks this way. A saint is someone who oozes out the goodness and the love of God. The saint is someone who is doing it instead of talking about it. And you and I have that kind of an experience. You know, in order for you and I to stay sober, we have to do it. We have to keep on giving. And giving is showing love. When you stop to love people, you get drunk. You know, there are now 2.5 persons in the whole world I don't like. You know what I do? I avoid them. And I have a hell of a time with myself, where I really should love everybody. But I can't. I can't be perfect. Someday, I hope, and then my time is up, I hope, that I love just everybody. And then I have been an alcoholic. And then God, in His goodness, even could use my alcoholism. This is always astonishing to me. He could use the worst in me for the very best. And then we go to places, and we go in times, and we don't know why. And then we may not say very formal prayers, but we know that His hand is behind us. And we are guided. And we have work to do. And then we also know that this will continue and go upwards and onward forever and ever. That's the great thing. God of experience, the God of good, the God of love. He ain't no policeman. He is like a father. He may not like what you and I are doing, but when your boy commits murder, you still love him, don't you? I do. I love mine. He may not like what you are doing, but he'll love you for what you are and what you can become. And so then all the troubles you have right on his shoulder. And thank him. And be grateful. And then we become blessed people. God bless all of you.